most people are not interested in taking fentanyl. They only transition, they are either transitioned passive voice to fentanyl by someone else or somebody, something else, or they can't find any heroin. And that's also what begins to happen. You begin to see fentanyl outcompete heroin. You begin to see more and more people get addicted to fentanyl. And if they survive their first exposures to fentanyl, then eventually they become addicted. Now, they don't last long. This is one of the ways fentanyl changes everything, as they say on the street. One of the ways is that there's no long-term fentanyl users really in America really much anymore. You get off of them or you die. And so this is really kind of the reality of the drug.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is journalist and former Los Angeles Times reporter, Sam Quinones, to talk about his timely and important book, The Least of Us, subtitled True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Provisional data from the CDC indicates that over 110,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year, approximately 70% of them caused by fentanyl, a painkiller which is 100 times more powerful than morphine. At the same time, Mexican traffickers have developed a new kind of methamphetamine, which is cheaper and more powerful than before, and has contributed to a dramatic rise in mental illness in our country and homelessness. Sam Quinones is with us today to tell us the truth about the drug epidemic, how it's destroying communities, and what we can do to combat it. It's my great honor to welcome journalist and author Sam Quinones as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Can we just start out with telling our audience about your background?
My name is Sam Quinones. I'm a journalist and author for 36 years, a lot of years in newspapers, a lot of years as a freelancer, which I am now. Written 4 books about Mexico, 2 about Mexico, where I lived for 10 years, and 2 others about the opioid epidemic and now fentanyl and meth, now that I'm a freelancer. I've been a crime reporter mostly, most of my life, beginning with a wonderful revelatory 4-year stint in the town of Stockton, California, during the height of the crack epidemic, where I basically learned to write and learned about law enforcement and crime and gangs and et cetera, began my crime reporting career. I've always kind of thought of myself as that. So. That's kind of a very quick nutshell of who I am.
Fantastic. And how did this book come about? Is this sort of a continuation of research that you've been doing?
Kind of, but so I came back from Mexico after 10 years in that country, writing mostly about immigration, political change. And I got back and found a job at the LA Times, which is LA is my hometown, kind of. So it was my hometown paper. Mm-hmm. And within a year, you began to see the drug wars, the cartel wars down in Mexico kick off, which was something we never saw.
Yeah.
When I was down there, these guys were very discreet. They'd found bodies in the ravine or bodies in the back of a car, but you began to see beheadings. Never saw that.
Yeah.
Began to see, body dumps of numerous bodies or people hanging from overpasses, that kind of thing. In time, my publisher or my editor put me on a team of reporters that cover that. Mm-hmm. My job was to cover how drugs cross the country once they cross the border. I was in LA speaking fluent Spanish. So I got onto that. And as part of that, I began to realize that we are now in the midst of a renewed use of heroin.
Yeah.
And I could not explain why that would be. I thought heroin was that old 70s drug, you know,
right.
Serpico and the French Connection.
Yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And why would we be getting back into that?
Yeah.
But anyway, I discovered this one story that I just totally enthralled me, which was the story that I tell in my book that became Dreamland, which is the story of this one town in Mexico in the state of Nayarit, where all the guys come north to deal heroin in a form that looks very much like pizza delivery. So you're delivering heroin as if you're a pizza delivery, and there's an operator standing by, and the addicts are calling, and this kind of thing. It was a remarkable story. I went down to the town for about a week, about 5 days, I guess it must have been, something like that. And so I wrote this story for the LA Times, and but the truth was, I did not understand, as much as I love the story, as much as I was astounded at how they had expanded. They'd gone from LA, Van Nuys, and San Fernando Valley, all across the West, and then now across the Mississippi River to many parts of the East, why they would have a larger market for heroin. And that was because I didn't understand this, because I was in Mexico, focused entirely on Mexico, when what we know as the classic opioid epidemic kicked off with the very aggressive prescribing of opioid painkillers by doctors, pushed very aggressively by pharmaceutical companies who made those pills. I had no idea about that. I was really so focused on Mexico, I don't really care about anything that wasn't about Mexico.
That wasn't taking place in Mexico at all.
Not at all. Not zero.
Yeah.
And so I come back. I didn't know what an OxyContin was. I didn't know what a Vicodin was. I didn't know any of this stuff. I didn't know much about addiction. What I really wanted to cover was drug cartels, immigration, gangs, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And but I realized I could not write about heroin traffickers from Mexico, which is another topic I really fascinated me, without understanding that the much, much bigger story was the story of the opioid epidemic and the heavy, heavy prescribing for years and years, just a relentless supply, escalating supply of opioid painkillers unleashed on the country coast to coast, because all the doctors were basically pressured or eagerly embraced this new revolution. And a lot of them were not eagerly embracing it. They really had to be pressured, but eventually they came around. And so you began to see OxyContin all over the place. And then, of course, eventually, a lot of those people got addicted, even though the pharmaceutical companies were saying, no, that's not possible. If you're a pain patient given these pills, you don't get addicted. Well, that was clearly not true.
Yeah.
And then a subset of the people who did get addicted to those pills eventually transitioned to heroin, which, of course, the Mexican trafficking world was only too happy to supply. I will say that the guys that I wrote about were the first ones to figure out that if you follow the pills are now this big thing. Mm. And if you follow the pills, you'll have a bigger market for your heroin than you ever had in previous times.
Right.
And that's what they figured out, first of all, in the area around Columbus, Ohio. One guy in particular that I wrote about was kind of the pioneer of all that. And so eventually, I wrote this book that included both of those stories, the pharmaceutical and doctors and opioids coast to coast in horrible, horrible quantities, and many people getting addicted. A lot of people, I have to say, were mightily helped by these pills, but there was a very significant percentage of people who were not. And then heroin was part of the Dreamland book. Along the way, what happened after the book came out was that all of a sudden, you begin to see this new awakening. When I was writing Dreamland, nobody wanted to talk about this topic.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, really? Like, my loved one's addicted. I'm ashamed. I'm mortified.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about it. After the book came out, what I began to experience, I assumed no one would read the book because nobody wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
But then after the book came out, it was just a remarkable experience we lived in my household, where more and more people coming out of the shadows into the light to tell their stories, more and more politicians interested, media coverage, and pretty soon more and more awareness all across the country. And I began to speak all across the country too. Mm-hmm. Huge, huge numbers of invitations that I could not have imagined when I was writing the book. And along the way, I began to see that the story itself was changing as I spoke, literally, as I spoke to these places. And that the story was becoming now no longer doctors, no longer pharmaceutical companies as much. They were feeling the pressure and the lawsuits, you know, just amazing numbers of lawsuits. When I turned my book Dreamland in, there were three lawsuits.
Wow.
Three.
Wow.
And they were all on hold.
Yeah.
Within a couple of years of the book, there was like hundreds and eventually 3,000 and all these attorneys general and everything. So I'm on the road then seeing, though, that the story itself is changing.
Yeah.
It's becoming now the source is no longer doctors.
Yeah.
It's no longer pharmaceutical companies. It's the Mexican trafficking world. And they have made a revolutionary transition away from the plant-based drugs, which was always their thing because they were all ranchers or farmers. They were not very sophisticated guys, but then their grandchildren, so to speak, were now global chemical traders. And they were now seeing the profit was really not in growing your drugs.
Yeah.
The profit was really in making your drugs from chemicals. And they had this one benefit, which was that they controlled the shipping ports in Mexico and Mexico City Airport and two shipping ports in particular along the western coast of Mexico. And they began to get these chemicals that could make these drugs. And you began to see fentanyl and methamphetamine, a depressant and a stimulant now made together and covering the country in the same way that the pills had at one point for many years covered the country.
Right.
And so that kind of led to the second book, which feels like a sequel, except for none of the characters are the same.
Uh-huh. But as you point out, and I thought this was a very interesting part of the book, is that the whole world of drugs and how they're distributed and made is changing so quickly.
Totally.
These cartels, these groups, they adapt. It's like on a dime.
And I think that the benefits for a trafficker. This is all about what benefits traffickers. This is about a supply story. Very strongly believe this after my reporting and writing on this. It's a supply story. And this is all about what benefits traffickers, not addicts, not users on the street. You don't have to, if you don't grow your drugs, if you make your drugs in a lab, you don't need irrigation or sunlight or farmers or really land at all.
Yeah.
What you need is, most importantly, is access to those precursor chemicals, because not all of them are made in Mexico. In fact, not too many are really made in Mexico. And so you get those chemicals and then you develop a workforce that knows what they're doing and is also kind of interested in making some money like that. And you begin to get huge numbers of producers. And so it's just really so much more profitable, probably certainly in the case of fentanyl, far less risky because it's such a potent drug.
Yeah.
It's very easy to smuggle, make a lot of money on a small quantity.
Yeah.
And so, all of this was happening, but they really learned the benefits of synthetic drugs from making methamphetamine, not fentanyl, making methamphetamine in the late 80s into the 90s, into the 2000s. They had mastered making fentanyl, but then the method for making fentanyl changed. They had to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about fentanyl first.
Sure.
And where it came from, and then how it transitioned from becoming developed for medical use to being distributed illicitly.
Well, fentanyl is actually a magnificent drug when used surgically, invented by Paul Janssen, Belgian chemist, one of the great scientific minds, I really believe, of the 20th century, who invented many, many drugs that really benefited mankind. And in fact, fentanyl was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's hard to imagine that now, he wanted an opioid that would do everything that drugs derived from the opium poppy would do, except for you didn't have to grow the opium poppy.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted it quick. And he invented fentanyl, which is, they say it's more potent. What it really is it just quickly penetrates the brain, gets into the brain much more quickly and much more fully than does say morphine,
right,
which was the other anesthetic.
Yeah.
It outclassed morphine very quickly. Morphine, you had to take people down to almost death to anesthetize them.
Mm-hmm.
Morphine, you were very long period afterwards, after surgery, doped up six hours, something like that. You know, fentanyl's benefit to anesthesiologists and surgeons was it took the patient into anesthesia and then very quickly out.
Wow.
Both in and out were very, very, very quick. And this allowed for all kinds of surgeries, It allowed for you to be semi-conscious.
Yeah, you mentioned this in your book, which is incredible. People having stomach surgery. And
Yeah. That happened to me. I had a heart attack. And by the way, fentanyl has been used in cardiac surgeries since it came on the market in 1960. I mean, it's a real workhorse of a drug.
Yeah.
Also used very aggressively by paramedics and EMTs and nurses and doctors in emergency rooms and so on. And yeah, I watched my own operation in a sense, in and out of dopiness, right? I'd come in and out. Yeah. But on the video, I could see this thing coming up through my body, about to put this stent in my artery.
Wow.
And then once they got that done and I stopped needing it, they took me out of fentanyl anesthesia. And within minutes,
yeah,
I was speaking coherently to the doctors, which would never have happened with morphine. So it's that one of the benefits to surgery is that in and out, that quick in. It's just the nature of fentanyl. That very nature of fentanyl makes it an enormously profitable drug on the street.
Yeah.
And so through the years, through the decades, occasionally you see these rogue chemists make the stuff, maybe a pound, maybe a kilo, not much, mm-hmm. but enough that it would create a sensation, and then people would call it heroin,
yeah.
or China White, it was known as, or really potent heroin.
Yeah.
It was not, it was fentanyl. And you began to see these little eruptions of addiction and or fentanyl, and then frequently, of course, death.
Yeah.
And then in 2006, I would say the big moment came when really the biggest mass die-off to fentanyl happened that we'd ever seen. It took place because a chemist in who had lived in the United States, learned to make fentanyl, gone to prison, learned to make it better, was deported, was hired by the Sinaloa elements of the Sinaloa drug cartel to make, in fact, ephedrine,
uh-huh.
which is a precursor to methamphetamine.
Yeah.
He said he eventually made fentanyl. He didn't make ephedrine for him.
Okay.
They paid for his whole lab, and it was outside Mexico City.
Yeah.
And he began to make fentanyl, knowing, as he did, that this was, and he told them, this is the most profitable drug you're ever going to encounter.
Uh-huh.
And so he made this fentanyl, and it sold like crazy. Of course, lots of people died.
Yeah.
This was mainly they sold it into the gang world in Chicago, and then it made its way to St. Louis, Detroit, Philadelphia, various places in between, and you begin to see this mass die-off, like hundreds and hundreds of people dying, and it was very alarming. They busted the lab in 2006, so it was about a nine-month lifespan of this lab,
mm-hmm.
and at that point, the die-off stops.
Yeah.
Right. But this is elements of the Mexican drug world. They're not forgetting this, and so eventually they become, get into the market for Chinese fentanyl. Chinese begin to manufacture Chinese chemical companies, send it, but they can only send it like in small quantities, like a pound,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they're sending it through the mail.
Yeah.
So you're not going to send like 10 kilos through the mail of fentanyl.
Right. Know?
So it's and they get the mail, it gets lost in the mail, what they send. And so for a long time, the first eruption after that was of fentanyl was like 2013, but really 14, 15, and 16. You really began to see, and that was to the first states who were really involved in the opioid epidemic, where the dealers there had been selling heroin, mm-hmm. and now saw fentanyl as their lottery ticket.
Oh, wow.
So they started selling this stuff, buying it on the web,
yeah.
off these chemical companies out of China, which send them, you know, a half a kilo,
right.
or like a pound, or maybe a half a pound, or whatever, small amounts, small quantities.
Yeah.
They have zero idea how to mix this stuff.
Uh-huh.
They're dope dealers on the street.
Yeah.
But now, proof of this was that a lot of them, they realized this is my lottery ticket, but in order to get the earnings from this lottery ticket, I have to mix this product in very, very small quantities with another inert powder.
Yeah.
And because you just can't sell this it's like a few grains of sand is worth of fentanyl is enough to get people high. A few more will kill you.
Wow.
So they're like saying, okay, I got to mix this. I can't sell a few grains of sand on the street.
Yeah.
So they mix it with fentanyl, with other powders. But the problem is they don't know a thing about how to mix actual pharmaceutical drugs of any kind. It's the first time really in the history of drug use in America where you're actually seeing widespread need to mix a drug in order to get its profit. And they don't know what they're doing. A lot of them end up buying, the myth is that a lot of them end up buying the magic bullet blenders.
Yeah.
You sell in Target or on those infomercials. It makes great salsa and scrambled eggs and all that stuff. Right. It's really a bad idea to mix your fentanyl that way because fentanyl is a powder.
Yeah.
It mixes with the powder. You don't mix powder with a blade. You don't, that's pro liquid.
Yeah.
So they don't know what they're doing. That's why you begin to see 2014, 15, 16 mass overdoses, like 50 in a weekend in one area or 75 in Cincinnati or Huntington, West Virginia, or whatever. But because this is still the Chinese chemical companies making this stuff mostly, there's a limit onto how much they can make and therefore how much fentanyl can spread.
Yeah.
It wasn't until really by 2015, 16, then really 17, you begin to see the Mexican trafficking world in large amounts begin to make fentanyl. Now they're not buying fentanyl from the Chinese, they're buying precursors.
Yeah.
The stuff that, and some of these precursors are very easy to turn into fentanyl or to turn into a precursor that's easy to turn into a fentanyl, that kind of thing. And so they're getting huge quantities of this stuff or relatively enough to make staggering quantities. That's when you begin to see the Mexican trafficking world transition to the counterfeit pills that look like a Percocet or a Xanax or whatever. Mm-hmm. When that happens, and all those things, of course, contain is fentanyl.
Yeah.
Then they begin to explode. And so now they're at first I interviewed the first woman to be smuggling those pills into San Diego area. She's now doing time in prison. She was smuggling thousands at a time. Well, that's quaint.
Yeah.
Quantities. Now you're talking hundreds of thousands. I was of pills coming in through every border crossing, probably almost every day. I saw that there's a Twitter feed of the guy who runs the Nogales Board of Entry in Arizona. And in 3-day period, they seized themselves 1.2 million of these pills. So it gives you an idea of just how much fentanyl is now being made. And what that means is over the next several years is that fentanyl goes from Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Indiana, those states right in there where the opioid epidemic was really big and the dealers had all their money tied up with selling to opioid addicts.
Yeah.
Now you begin to see the supplies just explode nationwide and go east and west and south. They go out to up to Maine, all through the south, up the rest of the Midwest, of course, the mountain states, and then out to the west. And that begins by the first mass overdose in California was 2018. And after that, it's just, through the roof.
Yeah.
New York, you're seeing it. You're seeing it down in various places in the South. I have a fellow I know, a recovering addict, is doing quite well now. I'm very happy to say who was addicted to fentanyl briefly and just in the beginnings of it all and got out of it because he'd probably be dead otherwise,
Yeah.
And so what you've got is this like massive supply that is now nationwide, very much like the way the pills saturated the country with the drug companies and the doctors before.
Right. And now these pills that are made in Mexico, there's no regulation. When you take these pills, you have no idea how much fentanyl is really in it.
What's also happening, two things generally happen. Two things. One is you take fentanyl without knowing it and you die.
Yeah.
The other is you take fentanyl because most people are not interested in taking fentanyl. They only transition. They are either transitioned passive voice to fentanyl by someone else or something else, or they can't find any heroin. And that's also what begins to happen. You begin to see fentanyl outcompete heroin. You begin to see more and more people get addicted to fentanyl. And if they survive their first exposures to fentanyl, then eventually they become addicted. Now, they don't last long. This is one of the ways fentanyl changes everything, as they say on the street. One of the ways is that there's no long-term fentanyl users in America really much anymore.
Yeah.
You get off of them, or you die.
Wow.
And so this is really kind of the reality of the drug. And so, yeah, it's mixed into other drugs.
Yeah, I had a friend whose daughter went to a party and she thought she was snorting cocaine and there was fentanyl in it and a bunch of the kids died.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And this is happening. I mean, one of the things that used to happen when I was writing the Dreamland book, I noted that the opioid epidemic was largely, almost entirely, really,
yeah,
a white thing. It was also Native American, but really it was mostly white.
Yeah.
With fentanyl has opened the door to the opioid because it is an opioid. It hits the same receptors in our brain, the same receptors and it creates the same reward pathways, that kind of thing, as opioids do. So what ends up happening is people get addicted to this stuff, and then they become fentanyl addicts.
Yeah.
In the Black community, that really they avoided the opioid problem because, well, there's a lot of reasons and it's a complicated story. But basically, I remember writing Dreamland and really not interviewing any Black people because there really was not a problem in that community.
Yeah.
Fentanyl has opened the door to the opioid epidemic in the Black community because so many drug users in the Black community, their drug of choice is cocaine. And as you just said, many of them believe they are using cocaine, and yet their dealers have now figured out that if you mix cocaine,
yeah,
with fentanyl, people will die, but you will also get a very, very committed,
yeah,
a customer base, because now they have to buy every day. And what's more, as I said, fentanyl, it takes you in and out very quickly. So you are always having to use throughout the day, particularly as your tolerance grows,
yeah,
you are using and using and using all day long, much more than you ever used heroin. So it becomes a wonderful drug,
yeah,
to be able to sell if you are a dealer. And that's kind of the case now, that you're seeing people dying and then other people getting addicted through a variety of means, maybe one of those pills or cocaine at a party, as you say, something like that. There's a lot of ways. And eventually they become addicts. But as I say, no one,
yeah,
survives. No one lives a long time,
wow,
on fentanyl. It kills people very, very quickly, even if you do survive your first exposures to it.
Yeah, I think that last year, over 100,000 people in this country died from fentanyl. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think 100,000 people overdosed, and their numbers are somewhere in around that 70% of those had it was fentanyl involved. I'm wondering what the other 30% were, because frankly, right now, everything on the street has fentanyl.
Yeah,
it's not a realistic idea to say, well, my client did not know that he was selling something that contained fentanyl. That's just pure nonsense. Everything has fentanyl. And if you're in the drug world, people know this.
Yeah,
this is not a difficult thing to know.
It sounds like it's a very, very difficult thing to combat because the pills are so small,
right,
and they can be smuggled in such small quantities.
And there's two things that are getting in the way of that, especially. First of all, the current administration of Mexico, I lived in Mexico, as I said, for 10 years. And I remember the current president as a senator and a mayor of Mexico City when I was there. And I remember him as a lucid, articulate guy.
Yeah.
Now I listen to him. I can barely handle listening to him.
Yeah.
He's seems dazed. He seems not in possession of his faculties. But one of the things you can say is that he has betrayed no real interest.
Yeah.
In dealing with the fentanyl problem coming out of Mexico. On the contrary, what he says is no, that we have no fentanyl problem in Mexico, which is pure nonsense. I think the LA Times did a fascinating story several months ago about the medical examiner of the city of Mexicali, which is right across from Calexico in California. This is a Mexican town, about a million people. This in Mexico, they don't test when you die. They don't give you a toxicology. They don't test what's in your bloodstream as you die, when you die.
Yeah.
Which means there's no understanding of what drug problems they might have on the ground at all, because that's where you find out what you have.
Sure.
This guy, bless his heart, began to do autopsies on every corpse that came into his office for the first, for a year, for 12 months, I think it was. And he found in that time that there was 23% of the corpses, of the bodies that had fentanyl in them. And that's just one town. Granted, it's on the border. It's going to be a place where a lot of fentanyl comes through.
Yeah.
But they're not doing that. So the president of Mexico says, no, we don't have any fentanyl problem. Pure nonsense.
Yeah.
Pure nonsense. He has no basis on which to make that statement. So we have one problem is there.
Yeah.
The other problem, I believe very strongly, is that in the United States, we allow the sale of assault weapons so easily.
Yeah.
And these assault weapons are, many of them have been smuggled south.
Yeah.
Along with the ammunition.
Yeah.
For them to arm the traffickers in their wars with each other, in their ability to kind of insist on impunity in whatever region they happen to be
That's
operating
a huge
in.
Business.
And yeah. those yeah. assault weapons are allowing them to make
yeah.
these drugs in quantities that are just staggering, fentanyl and methamphetamine. So we have two things that neither country really wants to address. One is the corruption and the frankly, the just, I think, terrible indifference that the current president of Mexico seems to show.
Mm-hmm.
And then another is our weapons. And if you check out the Nogales Twitter feed out of the director of Customs and Border Patrol in Nogales Port of Entry, you will see that he's all about this. He's putting up huge seizures every 2-3 times a week. And at times when they have them, seizures of assault weapons, they're going south. They're all these
yeah.
AR-15s, et cetera, and the ammunition as well.
So based on what you're saying, it sounds like fentanyl is becoming a problem in Mexico as well.
Yes.
It seems to be, you know, a lot of users in Mexico.
You have to assume that. You have to assume that when the Colombians began shipping their cocaine into Mexico in the 80s, first it was a strange relationship. First, they would bring the cocaine into Mexico. At the border, they give it to the Mexicans. The Mexicans who knew the border would transfer it across, would smuggle it across, and then they give it back to the Colombians in LA or in
yeah.
Dallas or someplace like that.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, that cocaine began to, Mexicans said, we'll take, you know, they kind of cut out the middleman in a sense, and they just began to send it to the Mexicans. And the Mexicans began to send them, cocaine began to come into like Sinaloa and places like this. And what you began to see is a lot of it stayed and a lot of people got addicted to cocaine, and cocaine became a real problem in certain many families and so on. So the idea that they could make fentanyl in Mexico and that it would not have some kind of problem, that it could not create some kind of drug use problem, I think is just, it's just nonsense. Honestly, it's very frustrating to listen to all this stuff.
Yeah.
When you know that this is just pure nonsense.
While the amount of fentanyl, meth, and other drugs crossing from Mexico into the United States is growing at an alarming rate, so is the flow of automatic weapons from the U.S. into Mexico, and mainly into the hands of the drug cartels. Last year, U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported intercepting 1,171 guns before they crossed into Mexico, nearly 7 times as many as they stopped in 2019. And according to experts, the number of guns seized is only a fragment of the hundreds of thousands researchers estimate are trafficked from the United States to Mexico each year. Many of last year's seizures involved AR and AK type assault rifles, which are the cartel's weapons of choice. Data from the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives indicates that between 2017 and 2022, nearly 124,000 guns were recovered at crime scenes in Mexico and subsequently traced. 68% of those guns, more than 83,000, came from the United States. Let's shift to meth. Can you talk a little bit about how it came into being and what it was used for, like during World War II?
Yeah, it's also an interesting story. So methamphetamine, its first incarnation in the United States was made by bikers.
Yeah.
Right? Hell's Angels.
Yeah.
Other biker groups. If you see the Rolling Stones documentary, Give Me Shelter, where they hire for some incomprehensible reason, they hire the Hells Angels to do some kind of security at this free concert in the Altamont Speedway in Northern California.
It's a disaster. Yeah. Yeah.
It would complete. And you see these guys out of their minds, these Hells Angels. So eventually though, what ends up happening is low income, working class white drug meth was for a long time. When I was in Stockton, that's what it was at first.
Yeah.
Little by little, the Mexicans figure out how to make it, that they can make it more efficiently and they can outcompete all those kind of half stoned bikers.
Right. Who are blowing up their kitchens and so on and so forth.
Right. And they were, so they bench, and the way they do it is with a method of making methamphetamine that uses the chemical ephedrine. Ephedrine is a decongestant.
Yeah.
And, it's in Sudafed, basically. That's where you get the Sudafed name. So the Mexicans begin making it in little farmhouses outside Bakersfield and Fresno. And, it's a big thing in the Michoacan state area of Mexico. And the farm workers in those areas, many of them are from Michoacan, up in Fresno and Baker, Central Valley, Stockton too, by the way.
Okay.
All of this was kind of beginning in the late 80s and into the 90s. Eventually, the law enforcement in California and nationwide begins to really attack it, and they are realized. And so they just move south. They move to Mexico.
Yeah.
So production of ephedrine-based meth moves to Mexico. I would say that pretty much by the late 90s, it's almost all down there now. And so what you have is there far less problem with law enforcement, of course.
Yeah.
And so you have these guys able to build labs, large labs, and invest in them without fear of losing their investment so much.
Yeah.
And then people getting knowledgeable how to make this stuff, and people getting, making the precursors, but also making maybe the glassware and other infrastructure you might need for. And so they become very astute and very good at making ephedrine-based methamphetamine. And the ephedrine they're getting is from the pharmaceutical industry, which imports a lot of ephedrine. And some percentage of that was diverted every year to the trafficking world. The thing is, though, that one thing that happens is that they can make ephedrine very efficiently. But they can't make enough of it to cover more than parts of the Western United States, because there is no, they just don't have enough of it.
Yeah.
And so you begin to see the methamphetamine come out of Mexico. It's cut significantly, I think. It's usually like 50% meth and 50% something else, or 60% meth or something like that. But it's not really much more than that. And it's really only in certain parts, LA, parts like this. In the rest of the country, methamphetamine becomes the purview of the classic, folk figure, the meth cook, cooking in motels, you say, or barns or whatever. But they're making tiny quantities. They're making grams, maybe an ounce. It's rare that you get enough chemical to make enough meth to make, say, like a pound of the stuff. And they're getting it all out of the pills, which they're distilling, which is why that you have to sign waivers to sell your, giving up your first child to get a Sudafed now. It's because they were using that to make methamphetamine. Well,
wow.
So that's the state of affairs for a number of years until 2008. In 2008, the Mexican government decides it's going to crack down on the amount of ephedrine that allow into the country. And that is when the supplies of ephedrine really drop. It's been dropping. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, but then it's bam, it's really low. So the trafficking world, seeing this magnificent, profitable thing, because that's what taught them the benefits of synthetic drugs, methamphetamine.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh man, this is great. And then all of a sudden they lose their golden goose, the ephedrine supplies, and they switch.
Yeah.
They switch to a new method, new for them method. There's really the old way that the bikers used to make it, using a chemical known as P2P, phenyl-2-propanone.
Mm-hmm.
And phenyl-2-propanone is really not a very efficient way of making methamphetamine. It stinks. There's a lot of chemicals. That's why the bikers always used to have to make their meth out in the desert or way up in the pines. They couldn't make it in the middle of the city because it would just, explode and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So what you got then was the Mexicans transitioning to that. And in the book, The Least of Us, I talk about the first exploded lab when they're still trying to figure out the P2P method, which happened in Guadalajara in 2006. They're still trying to figure it out. And these DEA agents come upon the lab, and it's clear that no ephedrine was involved. All of a sudden, it's a new chemical, and the chemists say, yeah, no, this is P2P and all this stuff. They're like, whoa, this is a different world. And sure enough, as time goes on, and particularly after 2008, the trafficking world in Mexico, primarily guys in the Sinaloa drug cartel, run an arm of the Sinaloa drug cartel run by a very well-known, now deceased, a trafficker named Nacho Coronel, becomes like the methamphetamine wing of the Sinaloa drug cartel, kind of, at first, certainly. And they begin to make P2P meth and then perfect it. And P2P meth, they figure out, has only one benefit over ephedrine meth, and that's a crucial one. And it's all about what we're facing now as a country.
Yeah.
And that is that P2P can be made many, many different ways. So you cannot regulate it the way you regulate. You cannot crack down on it the way you did with ephedrine.
Yeah.
Because if you crack down on this way of making P2P, there's all these other ways of making it. And they all involve legal, cheap, industrial, highly toxic chemicals. So you would have to like regulate all these chemicals in all these legit industries.
Yeah.
And so you just cannot do it. And if you have then access to the ports of entry on the shipping ports along Western Mexico, you have then access to all the world's chemical market, particularly China's.
Yeah.
And so you begin to get these huge quantities of these precursors used to make P2P and other elements that are needed in the and what you begin to see is by 2010, 11, 12, the supplies are getting bigger and they're getting better at it. They're not like they're not in so many exploding labs and so on.
Right.
They're getting better at it. And what you begin to see is then the story begins to unfold across the country. You begin to see the march of methamphetamine. And I peg it kind of at 2012, 13. I say that because by 2014, according to people who work Skid Row in Los Angeles, Skid Row, Los Angeles was for 20 years very solidly a crack area.
Yeah.
And now methamphetamine has dislodged it by 2014. So I'm figuring 2012, 13, I talked to one of the guys I talked to in the included in the book is actually a friend of mine, a gang member. I kind of know him from a lot of talking with him. And he was a meth dealer down in 2013 in Mexicali.
Yeah.
And it's just staggering. He couldn't believe the quantities of meth he could get his hands on just by walking into like a tire shop or something like that.
Wow.
And so what you begin to see then is the meth march across the country, and it's all over the West by 2015, 16. It's into the Midwest. And all over the Midwest by 2017, then 18. And by 2019, it's up in New England.
Yeah.
And in New England, they've never had meth of any kind, no meth cooks of any kind up there. It's really a rare thing.
Yeah. And as you say in the book, this P2P meth is different and it has a different effect on people.
Yeah. It's interesting bringing this up, Rob. First of all, let me say this about P2P meth. What you began to see then is methamphetamine coming in such catastrophic quantities, the only word for it I can really, is that it's now everywhere.
Yeah.
It's covering the country the same way fentanyl is, the same way as those pills did when the doctors were the source.
Yeah.
Not only that, the quantities that they're making down in Mexico are so large that the price collapses. We don't have pricing history much for fentanyl, but we do have pricing history for meth that goes back many years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now you're seeing historic low prices, sometimes 95, sometimes it's just flat out free.
Yeah.
Right. On the street. And that at the same time that they're covering the country. So now there's meth in Maine.
Yeah.
There's meth in New Hampshire. I was just on the phone with some guys in New Hampshire and they were like, yeah, we got this meth up here. It's incredible. And it's so none of those meth cooks exist anymore. They've all been running right out of business. Nobody's cooking meth in the United States.
Yeah.
To any degree anymore. At the same time, what you begin to see is this along with the march of meth that connected to that methamphetamine are very pronounced, very rapid onset symptoms of schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Very quickly, not gradually. Meth does this to you over months and months.
Yeah.
It's been proven any kind of meth, if you use it long enough, this is not that case. This is right down, right off the cliff. You're all of a sudden, you're certain that that black car is is following you from the FBI.
Yeah.
You're talking to the walls. You're talking to you're feeling hands grab you wherever you are or in your car.
See it every day on the street.
Absolutely. You begin to see it. I think what I think happened was too, that this methamphetamine and certainly fentanyl, now both of them in staggering quantities nationwide, become big drivers in our homelessness, in our mental illness issues, that now mayors that I read about say that this is one of the biggest problems they face. It was not that big a problem 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You would not have found a mayor saying 10 years ago that that mental illness is now one of our biggest issues. And there's lots of reasons for mental illness, but certainly a major driver of it now is this methamphetamine in staggering, unrelenting quantities. It's not like a wave. It's like a new high tide. That's the way to think about it.
Yeah.
Now, I came upon this idea. I was going to write a story, and I did, about methamphetamine production capacity in Mexico being through the roof, just being unlike anything we've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a damn good story. And I thought that was something we needed to be aware of as a country, that we have right next to on our flank is a trafficking culture that can make tons and tons and tons of this stuff constantly all year round, you know. And then I came upon this idea from a guy I got to know that this meth might be causing this mental illness. I began to call around.
Mm-hmm.
This one fellow told me about it. I said, well, I got to check.
Yeah.
And so I'm calling all over the country. This is the first summer of COVID. Couldn't go anywhere. So I just called and called and called all these different places. Yep. Oh, yeah, we are seeing that. You know, come to think of it, all these people were like, damn right. Yeah. And if initially what I thought, when I realized as I got into that story that this methamphetamine was creating all kinds of some symptoms of schizophrenia, hallucinations, paranoia. Wow.
Yeah.
Through the roof. You know, unbelievably weird stuff, you know, but people who never had this problem, all of a sudden they're like barking like dogs, you know? And I thought to myself, why would this be happening? Well, no, I look around, who's writing about this? Who's talking about this? Anybody doing a study on the new meth coming out? No.
Yeah.
Zero. Not one. Nobody is studying
this. Wow.
So what I wrote in the book was my hunch at that time, this was more than 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
When I turned that manuscript in, my hunch at that time was that it might, I said I didn't really know, might have something to do with the chemicals that are being used in the production of P2P meth, which are all toxic, used in gasoline and photography and tanning and all this stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I would say that the book spurred people to think about this now.
Yeah.
Probably not as much as I would have liked, frankly, but to some degree. And that there's now another idea that's probably that I kind of come to believe is probably more likely.
Yeah.
And that is this, that down in Mexico, without any law enforcement molesting them in any way, they are able to make methamphetamine as much as they want.
Yeah.
And they are then sending it north, uncut.
Mm.
All right. Not like the ephedrine stuff that they used to make up here in the United States, which they cut it, you know, 50-60% or they whatever.
Yeah.
Now you're seeing methamphetamine that the chemists, the DEA chemists are showing tests that show 97%, 98%, 99% methamphetamine.
Wow.
No adulterant.
Wow. So powerful stuff.
Extraordinary. No human brain has ever consumed.
Yeah.
And then on the street, there's no reason to cut it on the street. That's frequently where you'd see it being cut.
Yeah.
There's no reason, because cutting your drug means the reason you would do it is to keep it's to prolong the life and to make more money.
Sure, sure.
But there's two things that work against that. First of all, everybody's got meth.
Yeah.
There's no you don't have any problem finding more meth to sell, because all around you, I talked to this guy in West Virginia.
Yeah.
He told me used to be this, he was a long time, he used to be very difficult to find supplies Now I could tell you when I got arrested, I could have found five guys within 10 miles of me, who each of whom would be able to sell me 10 pounds of meth right then.
Wow.
Right. So in West Virginia,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So you're seeing the staggering quantities of this stuff all across the country.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to cut it at the local level. On the contrary.
Because it's so cheap and it's so available.
It's so prevalent. Yeah. It's all about supply. Yeah. As I said, it's all about supply. This story is about supply. It's not about demand creating supply. It's quite the opposite. Supply creating demand. And so what you've got then is you've got all these, this meth that's coming across the country. It's being used almost in the same state in many cases, I think, as it was made at the whatever kind of lab it was made in back in Mexico, right? And so this is the, as I said, this is the most potent meth, likely the most potent meth, certainly in the quantities we're seeing it, never been visited on the human brain in the quantities we're seeing it now across America.
Yeah.
And that may have more to do, and still, I think the jury's kind of out, but I'm ready to say, I think that may have more to do with the rapid disintegration, mental disintegration that you are seeing among people who use this stuff, and you're seeing in tent encampments, and you're seeing it on the homeless, among the homeless on the street.
Yeah.
It's really, I think, a major driver. Two things. It's a major driver of why people get homeless.
Yeah.
Although there's many reasons why people become homeless.
Right.
Economic reasons, health reasons, prison, domestic violence.
But as you point out, it's just been an explosion in the last 10 years, the homeless problem.
And I think one of the reasons, one of the things that meth does too, is regardless of why you're homeless, it keeps you homeless.
Yeah.
You know, you're using it, and meth makes some kind of weird twisted sense on the street because it keeps you up.
Yeah.
It makes it your body is not as cold because your body's revving at a higher degree. It keeps you up so you get raped or robbed. And so but once you start using it, it becomes very, very difficult to get those people into a state of mind where they are ready for any kind of treatment. And so you are seeing, and this is also true of fentanyl, you are seeing on the street now people refusing treatment.
Yeah.
Look, the temperatures are about to drop to the teens. You need to get up. No, I'm fine. I'm good. You know, no problem.
Yeah,
or you're being pimped out and beaten.
Yeah.
There's feces everywhere. There's filth everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And then the attitude on the street of many outreach workers is, oh, well, okay, fine.
Yeah.
I think that's a mistake, too. But anyway,
this is
kind of, but it's, in my opinion, it's all created because the stories that I've just told you about fentanyl, and just all a reflection of the enormous quantities that they are able to make, unmolested by law enforcement to a great degree, protected by the guns that are smuggled from here down to there, and the control of the shipping ports that through which they get all those chemical precursors.
Yeah, no. I've visited some homeless encampments in Los Angeles myself, and I mean, it's bizarre. The population has definitely changed in the last like 5 years.
Totally.
And I've talked to some of these people and they're all using meth. And I say, well, where do you get it?
Yeah.
And they say, well, we get it for free.
See, this is the thing.
Like, people come here and hand it out. And I'm like, well, who are these people who are coming around handing it out? You know, they're not exactly sure, but it's the same people all the time just coming and handing it out.
Yeah. It's confused somehow. I don't understand how the politics of it are very twisted. I think that it's somehow compassionate to leave people on the street. The problem with leaving people on the street is that the street will kill you very quickly, too. The drugs are part of that, but beatings, all of this, you know.
Yeah, the crime is horrible. And as you point out in your book, because of the nature of the drug and how it affects people psychologically, these people want to be out on the street.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting about all drugs of abuse is that it will do that to some degree. That's what the Bowery was in New York City in the 70s, you know,
with the heroin.
Lou Reed's Times Square, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It was all about guys, alcohol. That was alcohol doing that.
And yeah.
It isolates you. And what it also transforms your brain chemistry to really kind of squelch or at least dampen down the basic instincts for survival. I mean, so you saw people sleeping on the street in the middle of winter, or even in the summer. It's hard enough in the winter. In the summer, too, it's pretty bad. And so all drugs do that to some degree.
Yeah.
And this has, in my view, a lot to do with how available the supply.
Yeah.
Is it available? Well, alcohol is very available, as we know.
Right.
Right. What's happened with fentanyl and meth is that they are so prevalent.
Yeah.
That they almost behave like legal drugs because they're about that prevalent, particularly if you're in that world. Now, for me, I would have a hard time finding fentanyl.
Yeah.
For you, you'd have a hard time. But if you're on the street, fentanyl's everywhere. It's free, as you say. And if you're particularly, if you're a woman, methamphetamines, damn, it's like free all day long.
Yeah.
Right. And pay in other ways, of course. But and so what ends up happening, I think, is that same squelching, that same hijacking of the brain chemistry that you saw in the Bowery in New York City in the 70s and the 60s and 70s, and you saw in Skid Row in LA, same time.
Right.
And Tenderloin in San Francisco and some other areas of the country. Now you are seeing that same effect, not so with alcohol. Still alcohol is a problem. Obviously, it's a very big deal.
Right.
But fentanyl and meth, because they're so prevalent and so potent.
Yeah, so potent, I would say.
And although that combination.
Yeah.
And because this is a new high tide, not a wave that ends. It's a new high tide that doesn't end. You are seeing all these people have the same reaction. I don't really want to. I'm fine here. And you're fine.
Yeah.
You're not fine. You know, I had a very interesting conversation with a drug counselor at a speech I was given not long ago, a couple months ago. And she came up to me and she said, we're talking. She said, you know, my clients, depending, of course, on when you talk to them, they are terrified of two things. Number one is they are terrified of dying from fentanyl. And number two, they are terrified of being away from fentanyl. You know, so you get, it depends. It's like one moment.
Yeah.
Get me off the street. I know I'm going to die. Because everybody knows they're going to die if they keep using this stuff. It's just proven, right, to them. They see it daily, graphically.
Yeah.
And then as soon as they're haven't had it for a while, no, I got to go. I got to meet a friend, you know, about a thing.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you've got, but that's the amazing effect of prolonged, highly potent, very, very prevalent drugs on the brain.
Yeah.
Right. At one point, you know, rationally your brain say, hey, this is really bad.
Right.
Get away. And then the other moment it's like, the brain chemistry that's been twisted is like, hey, no, you go find that. Go get it.
I mean, you point that out in your book too, illustrated very well, that these drugs change, as does sugar and as do a lot of other substances.
Sure.
They actually change the brain chemistry.
Yes.
The rational brain is just pushed aside. I mean, there's a dependence.
The idea that there could be any rational decision-making going on is when you see it graphically in person, you understand how it's kind of nonsense to believe that this is any rational decision making.
In the TV show Breaking Bad, lead character Walter White starts his meth making journey using the pseudoephedrine reduction method. But when the US and Mexican governments began strictly regulating its sale, White soon shifted to the P2P phenyl-2-propanone method, and meth went from a party drug to something much more powerful and sinister. Before people who used meth were able to hold down jobs, pay their bills, maintain a family, and conduct their lives more or less without disruption. But the P2P meth produced hallucinations, schizophrenia, and horrible paranoia, and led to people losing their jobs and becoming homeless. Could you talk about for a minute the Chinese involvement in all this?
Yeah.
Because this is a subject that, you know, is bandied around in the media.
And I'm going to talk a little bit about it, but I'm also limited because I have not done a lot of reporting I've never been to China.
Okay.
And so I'm not, I want to make clear to people that, this is like, there are other people who know more about this, but I think it's clear that, well, first of all, let me go back. China in the early 80s was, you know, still a third world country. Then Deng Xiaoping with his revolution of economic capitalism and so on. And pretty soon, and in by the way, in 1985, Paul Janson signed an agreement with the Chinese government to allow Chinese chemical companies to make fentanyl, license the making of fentanyl. And he wanted access to the China market. It wasn't going to happen. And instead of it being pirated, he decided, okay, I'm going to sign this agreement. And it's really since 1985 that Chinese chemical companies have known how to make fentanyl. Mm-hmm. What's happened in between, though, is this is obviously an economic explosion.
Yeah,
the last 40 years in China, and now you have, you know, used to have very limited, very you know, rudimentary chemical. Now you've got thousands of, and they're very good at what they do, and you know,
yeah.
And so, for a lot of reasons, probably too complicated, and I don't want to get them wrong. But basically, the Chinese chemical companies, some of them, not all of them, began to see that they could sell fentanyl on the web. Some of them on the dark web,
yeah.
And some of them on the open web that you and I use,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so you've got this expansion into that market by certain companies that are out of China, right?
Yeah.
And so then more join. And it becomes, again, that's where the supplies begin to start being sent through the mail,
yeah,
to dealers who once dealt opioid painkillers may now have switched to heroin along with their customers. But whatever the case, now they're getting fentanyl in small, like I say, negligible quantities,
yeah,
but still enough because it's fentanyl to create serious, serious problems within those few states.
Yeah.
There's certain areas of China, I'm sorry, that have always produced chemicals for that could be used for methamphetamine. I would say that there was this moment when the Chinese chemical companies, because the Chinese government put a real kibosh on that, on the fentanyl thing.
Mm-hmm.
Largely because they had the opium wars.
Yeah.
In which it was an absolute
devastating
travesty of history.
Yeah, absolutely.
That the British,
yeah,
waged wars to make China
force them to keep
force them to consume the opium that they were making, they were growing the poppies they were growing in India.
Yeah,
you know, it's, you look back on that and you go, damn, if I were Chinese,
that'd be pissed.
I would be royally,
yeah,
that would be a grudge that would be hard to forget.
And they haven't,
you know, but. And since the opium dens and all that, they didn't have any of that before the opium wars in the mid-1800s, you know? You get the weight of history, too, coming along with this. But eventually, the Chinese companies, Chinese government, I'm sorry, puts a limits on which companies can actually produce fentanyl. And already, I think that the Mexicans were already figuring out, forget pound at a time.
Yeah.
An ounce at a time, 2 kilos at a time, even. We want the chemical precursors. We'll make it here.
Yeah.
And that was already the case by the time they were already making significant quantities of fentanyl by the time the Chinese government put a kibosh on the on the actual exportation of fentanyl from their companies. But of course, the companies, the chemical companies just switched to making the precursors. And there's what is it, 4-ANPP? Oh, I'm getting that wrong, I think. But that's almost fentanyl. You could buy that in China, and you just make it into fentanyl very quickly. And then there's another one that can be made into 4-NPP, and then you do that. Same process. It's not hard.
You point out that they outlaw one precursor, and then 2 weeks later, they come up with a new one.
Yeah, and the Chinese government has said, well, you know, we'll do that for fentanyl, but these chemicals are used for other things. My feeling when it comes to fentanyl is that some of these chemicals are not used for almost anything else except for fentanyl. But
yeah,
so maybe they might want to think about dealing with some of those chemicals too. Now with methamphetamine, that's a whole other ball.
Yeah, yeah.
Game there, you know.
And how much of this is becoming an international problem? Are you seeing growing fentanyl addiction and methamphetamine in Europe?
I would say that so far, I'm surprised at how limited that has actually been.
Okay.
My big question is, and I don't know the answers to these, okay? Yeah. I'm just asking. This is stuff that we should be watching, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
A couple of things. One is, what happens to Afghanistan? Because there is no point anymore. Fentanyl makes it pointless to grow poppies for heroin.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever. So if you have fentanyl and you can make it fairly easy, why would you grow? You can grow poppies for morphine for the medical industry, the legitimate medical industry, but why would you make it for heroin? You know, it just seems like to me that eventually heroin will just kind of die out if everybody knows how to make this stuff.
Right.
So what happens to Afghanistan? Do they switch to fentanyl?
Yeah.
Europe has had certain issues with fentanyl when Afghanistan heroin has been kind of suppressed briefly. Mm-hmm. And so you saw that in Sweden. Estonia had a problem, I think, a while back. This was a good number of years ago in the early 2000s and so on. So these are kinds of things that I think we might want to be aware of and looking at. Right now, the poppy market in Mexico is in depression.
Yeah,
it's like the great poppy depression down there right now, because there's nobody who wants to buy poppies. There's nobody in America who's addicted to fentanyl. The thing about supplies of fentanyl, it's so vast.
Yeah,
what that does is it takes you, the user, up to enormous tolerances every day, because you got to be using it all day long. You know, I was in Tucson.
Yeah.
When was it, like 8 months ago? So I'm like, there was the counselors and so on were telling me, and recovering addicts were telling me, people are smoking 30, 50, 60, 70, 80 of these pills a day.
Oh my God.
It's because that's what fentanyl does. You kind of always have to be using to keep the withdrawal beast.
It only lasts for a short period of time.
Short period of time. And that's what that it gets back to what we started talking about at the beginning of the conversation, which is that's the nature of fentanyl.
Yeah.
Right? In and out. And that's what makes it a great drug surgically.
Yeah.
It makes it a torment if you were a user.
Yeah.
And an enormous bonanza.
Yeah.
If you were a trafficker, and particularly if you're a street dealer.
Right.
You know, so.
Right.
And then, of course, there is vast chemistry literature in legitimate chemistry journals and whatever about drugs that have been invented by chemical companies or drug companies that they never could find a real commercial use for, that you may now see taking the place of fentanyl.
Yeah.
Because I cannot imagine anybody, certainly in Mexico, making money off this stuff saying, okay, yeah, I'll go back to growing marijuana.
Yeah. Why?
That's just simply not going to happen, I don't think, you know.
Yeah.
So you get now new drugs, the nitazine drugs. There's isotonitazine, etotonitazine, I can't even remember them all. And I've not met anybody who actually knows a definitive way of pronouncing those words because they were invented by SIBA Corporation in Switzerland in the 50s, I believe they were.
Yeah, yeah.
And they never found a legitimate commercial use for them, mainly because they so quickly suppress the respiratory system, like all opioids do, except this one, these do it much quicker. But now you've seen, and I mentioned these in the book, you've seen the nitazine drugs since about 2019, you know, show up. And so fentanyl, though, is a difficult drug to dislodge if you have a government that's not paying any attention to it, doesn't want to pay any attention to it.
Yeah.
And if you have cartels armed to the to the teeth with weapons, many of which they bought here.
Yeah. And the devastation on our society, as you point out in the book, and I mean, it's just incredible. And we see it. The first symptom is in the homeless explosion of the number of homeless. But that's the first symptom.
Yeah, right.
It's just literally destroying the brains of tens and hundreds of thousands of people.
And fentanyl is, as I said, you know, killing people quicker than anything we've ever seen on our streets. And the amazing idea is that both of these drugs are nationwide. There's no longer any difference, regional difference in drug use, really.
Yeah.
To any appreciable degrees, to some degree, maybe. But you're finding fentanyl and meth, or meth and fentanyl
everywhere.
Everywhere you go. And I know this because I've traveled since The Least of Us came out in end of 2021. I've traveled all over the country. I've been in, you know, Virginia, I've been in Oregon, I've been, you know, all these different places, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and every place I go, I'm asking people constantly, and I'm talking to conferences of drug counselors or judges or whatever. Every place I go, the answer is always the same. We're seeing fentanyl and meth, or we're seeing meth and fentanyl.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing change. But again, you know, synthetic drugs change everything if it's in the context of coming from a region where they have absolute access to staggering, almost unlimited quantities of precursors, and they have an enormous ability to smuggle those drugs north.
And we're just starting to learn, as you point out in your book, how to reach these people when they're addicted to these things and treat it. And it's very, very, very difficult, as you point out.
Yeah.
Whole new level of treatment. And the other thing that you point out is it comes at a time when we're so separate from one another.
Yes.
And these drugs, they're the epitome of that.
Right.
You know, people just sort of withdraw from society. They almost withdraw from their rational brain to the point where they don't care about, you know, their teeth falling out or their, you know, whatever is happening to them. It becomes all about this drug. If we don't get our hands around this, it is going to be like The Walking Dead.
Well, it's very much like that right now. And it's a really scary thing to watch this. And we are ignoring it in a way that we came not to ignore the opioid problem, largely because the opioid problem was viewed as somebody else's doing.
Yeah.
Doctors.
Yeah.
Pharma companies.
Right.
So you have major thousands, as I said, thousands of lawsuits against.
And you could ultimately sue them, as you point out.
Exactly. Now, we've dislodged, I think $54 billion from pharma companies, from chains, from, manufacturing, all these places, which I think is a good thing. I think this is an outrageous thing that took place.
Yeah.
But with fentanyl and meth, it's easier to blame the person that you see wandering around. And it's scary too. You know, methamphetamine to me is the pure, unvarnished, ravaged face of addiction.
Yeah.
It's what addiction really is. It is a complete disintegration.
Yeah.
It's a raging, sometimes violent, sometimes very difficult to difficult to control. It's almost the very poster child of addiction is methamphetamine in many, many ways.
Yeah.
And we just don't want to deal with that.
Yeah.
A football player who got addicted to the pills because he had an injury and was given these pills and then eventually ended up on the street. That's a little different maybe, but somebody on meth who's out of his mind, you know, or so, overwhelmed by negative stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very difficult thing to get your arms around. People don't want to hear it. So long as it doesn't affect them.
But thank God for your books and the work that you do, because at least you're pointing it out, and hundreds of thousands of people every year are being affected by this.
And it's easy to say that it doesn't affect me, but the truth is it almost always is. Even if it's not a family member of yours, there's a huge amounts of budget going to deal with this stuff now.
Yeah,
there's you don't know. I mean, people see folks show up in their backyard out of their minds.
Yeah.
You know, thinking that they are.
I see it every day. I'm here in Westwood, you know, near UCLA, and every time you go out, you see some man or woman, you know, screaming or talking to themselves.
Right. That is the price of Mexico doing nothing and the price of the guns that we sell to people so easily that then are smuggled south.
And when you talk to the Mexican, from their perspective, it's like, well, you're the guys who want this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, if you didn't have this huge demand, we wouldn't be making it. Nobody would be doing it.
Right, exactly. Except for in this case, this is really about supply creating demand.
Yeah.
That is really the case. And truth is, opioids have always been that way.
Yeah.
That was what the opioid epidemic was about. It was about creating. That's what the Sackler family knew all about.
Yeah. That was the cocaine explosion in the 80s. The same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And when I lived in Mexico, I didn't really write about drugs, didn't really know much about it. And I really didn't dig to. And so I kind of bought that idea. As soon as I began to really dig in, my feelings that would be, you know, as a reporter, you always kind of want to be able to pivot with the facts. And I have to say, I pivoted. I do not believe this is a demand-driven thing. Demand is part of the story. It always has to be.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about what is the real source of the problem, I think, well, there's other things too. There's our own isolation, as you're talking about. There's our own, all the things that lead to mental illness in this country. These are all parts of the story, of course.
Sure.
But when it comes to drugs, to me, these are drugs that are creating demand.
Yeah.
And really not the other way around.
Yeah. Well, Sam, thank you so much. You know, your books are wonderful, so important today. Thanks for going into this dark issue and shedding some light on it.
You're welcome.
Because it's so important. And if we don't do something about it, it's going to get bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Opioid-involved overdose deaths have risen steadily in the United States, from 21,089 reported by the Center for Disease Control in 2010, to 47,600 in 2017, to 68,630 in 2020, to preliminary estimates of over 110,000 for 2023. According to data from the 2021 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, more than 16.8 million people aged 12 or older, or 6% of the population, have used methamphetamine at least once during their lifetime. And in 2021, an estimated 2.5 million people in the United States reported using methamphetamine in the past 12 months. In that same period of time, homelessness in the U.S. has spiked. A count conducted by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development in 2023 found that more than 650,000 people were living in shelters or outside in tents or cars. That was up a whopping 12% from 2022. None of this is good news. But until we come to terms with the seriousness of these problems, we'll never find the urgency to seek solutions. That's why the work Sam Quinones is doing is so important, and his latest book, The Least of Us, is essential reading. Our best defense, he concludes, perhaps our only defense, is building community. It's my great honor to name journalist and author Sam Quinones as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.